It's crazy how things changed since we last spoke, actually. Like,
it really is. Yeah, it really is. I think, I can't remember the last time we spoke, but...
It was right after the 11 questions paper.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so...
Yeah.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, so we were, I mean, we were optimistic then, right? We were overweight U.S. equities. That's when we were sort of first investigating this idea of a productivity expansion in the U.S., but...
Yeah.
I mean, there's been a lot since then, and I think what's really interesting is this divergence that's emerged. Sorry, I'm trying to clean my glasses here.
That's okay.
This divergence that has emerged and is actually, I think, going to persist between Canada and the U.S. Like,
I mean, it was a. Our conversation in January was. I mean, that was where you did, in fact, speak about the overweight to U.S. equities, but, I mean, that was a great call.
It was. I mean, we have a rule on our team to on our team to never celebrate good calls.
Yeah.
Because we're sort of a...
Understandably.
We're superstitious bunch. Don't act like it's your first time in the end zone sort of thing, but... And we're always going to be really incremental, right? So, in hindsight, the moderate overweight to U.S. equities, you can easily say, that should have been twice as big, but you don't know in the moment, right? So this is the thing with investing is like, we're always going to be kind of incremental because we're not really running the funds with a back up the truck mentality. Like,
right.
It's just not how we operate. It's not in our DNA and it's not the result of our research process, but I do think what's really interesting is what we're seeing now in terms of this divergence, in terms of Canada versus the US. I mean, like I have my Bloomberg open right now because it lets me check stats easily if we want to pull up the most recent things. But I think it's kind of fascinating and maybe a bit of an unknown fact that the Canadian economy essentially didn't grow at all last year, right?
Wow.
And our research team, in fact, thinks that we were in a recession.
Yeah, and that won't be confirmed for some time, right? I mean, there's always a lag time involved in actually confirming these things.
Well, exactly. I mean, so between the start of 2023, Q1 2023 to now, the Canadian economy has grown by 0.5%, the level of Canadian economy. So the size of the Canadian economy has grown by 0.5%. And to put that in perspective, that number for the U.S. Is, suspense is building here. from the start of 2023, to today, U.S. economy has grown by 3%, right?
That's remarkable. I mean,
it's fascinating. I was digging into some of these. I always like to kind of, I dig on a bunch of stats before we chat.
Right.
Just to make sure I've got kind of lots of interesting ammo. There's a better word for that. But, the U.S. economy, I think this is a striking one. So if you look at the size of the U.S. economy in inflation-adjusted terms, the U.S. economy is almost 12% larger today. The size of the economy is almost 12% larger today than it was at the start of 2019. Like, that's unbelievable. But this idea that the U.S. is pulling away. I mean, to give you the same number for Germany, it's 0.5% bigger. To give you the number for Japan, zero. I mean, so this idea, even for Canada, so Canada's economy is 6% larger than it was at the start of 2019, but really for the last year and a bit, it's been almost a flat line. And a lot of that boost is coming from, gigantic immigration flows.
Right. Right?
Like
right.
Once in our lifetime type of immigration flows. I think what's happening in the U.S. is really striking. But yeah, I think these themes of like, this U.S. exceptionalism idea pulling away, like the U.S. pulling away a productivity expansion. I think that's also increasingly becoming part of the consensus. It's not quite fully baked into the consensus, but, you know, productivity, again, I made a joke a little while ago. I said, you know, productivity 10 years ago, productivity growth was one of these things we never talked about, right? Like putting oat milk in your coffee, you know, it's like, it's just something we never talked about. And now it's like, you're seeing productivity stories in mainstream media. You're seeing a fantastic speech by Deputy Governor of the Bank of Canada, Carolyn Rogers, on productivity. Excellent speech from, I think, March. It's a wonderful speech. It's very, very easy to understand. And I think it's because it has such important implications for the path of growth forward and the sustainability of growth and really standards of living, right? So it's...
Right.
Productivity is the magic elixir, really, for everything.
Well, one of our contributors wrote an entire post about productivity last year that we were in a productivity boom, or a mini productivity boom. I brought that point up with one of our other quantitative guests, and his counter argument was, you know, no, there isn't a productivity boom happening, right? So there's so many, like, this is the thing with this business, right? And with economics, is that the views where not only do the views vary widely as to the facts and the interpretation of facts, but there's also, you know, divergent attitudes about whether or not something like productivity even matters. And I mean, it does, the argument that was being made was that it's productivity that will contribute to us getting out of this inflationary period. And because it will bring disinflation or deflation with it, or some factor of either with it. But that was why, and I think that was why the other guest that we were speaking to, that I was speaking to, had the counter argument that that wasn't the case. But again, as you know, interpretation it's subject to opinion. It's subject to a lot of different things, and whether or not you believe in something or you know, as a contributing factor. But I feel like, you know, this year, you know, we know what the facts are, right? Stocks have had and continue to be having quite a run.
Yep.
And to new all-time highs in some cases. But the indices definitely have hit all-time highs as well. And then there's some we've had some recent pullback and volatility reaction to today's jobs numbers.
Sure. Yep.
But at the same time, the bond market, since we last spoke, has given back all of December's anticipated rate cut excitement.
Yeah.
And we had a convoy of Fed presidents rolling out new expectations for whether or not there would be two rate cuts, one rate cut, and then that culminated with Neil Kashkari saying there might not be any. You know, we watched the U.S. 10 years and 30 years yields rising back to where they were in early December. Mm-hmm. And so that's my first question for you, is what does that all mean to you? And was it at all surprising to you to see how well stocks have performed while bond yields are rising concurrently?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. I mean,
It's weird, right? I mean,
it depends on how we think about, it sort of depends on how we think about the drivers of growth right now, productivity, and honestly, what that means for, I hate to bring it up so early in our conversation, but our star and the neutral rate of interest, right?
Well, that's been a topic that has come up, right?
Yeah. So it's early in the conversation to drop the R star, R star reference, but I kind of think
that's the neutral rate.
Exactly. Yeah, that neutral rate of interest. But I sort of think of all of these things as a little bit endogenous, right? So these are all linked in important ways. But I think if I had to chop up those questions into a few different questions, I mean, again, I've been doing this a lot because of the folks I speak to and The internal portfolio managers that I communicate with regularly actually just did a big conversation this morning, you know, with almost 300 Fidelity folks internally. And I tried to think about, I'm really trying to think about the productivity expansion. So first, the first question is like, why should we care about productivity, right? And what does it do? And then I think the related question is, what does that mean for the episode that we're in right now, which I think, Pierre, was your question, and
right,
and how does that follow on from rates? So if I, and again, each one of those questions has tentacles as well, but that first question around, you know, what is productivity and why does it matter? That's the place I think we should start, right? So I think of productivity growth, right? So productivity growth statistically is normally measured as like output per hour, output per worker, right? It's a really easy concept to measure when we all worked on factory lines, right? Making widgets, right. Where you could add more people and get more output, or you could make people more efficient and get more widgets made. It's a much more difficult concept in the service sector where essentially, you know, 75 or 80% of developed economies are employed and most of the GDP is produced in a service sector. But the reason productivity growth matters is because productivity growth gives you, can give you, you know, higher rates of, well, ultimately it can give you a higher stall speed for an economy, right? So it's one of the ingredients into a potential growth rate of an economy, which can boost the stall speed of an economy. And if you boost the stall speed of an economy, and what I mean by that is achieve higher rates of GDP growth without stoking inflation. I mean, right. That's the ultimate goal, right? So that means better labor market outcomes, higher wages, lower inflation or slowing inflation, higher rates of growth, and increasing standards of living, right, over the medium term. It is really the most important and critical thing for achieving long-term boost to economic growth. Now, there's a few ways to achieve, to boost potential growth, productivity. Most economists think of basically three ingredients. The first is capital deepening, right? So that's investing in better technology, right? So that's, that's giving us better tools that we can use to work. That's giving
new machines, new processes, right?
Exactly,
new AI.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's very hard to know what it is. But again, it was much easier when you're moving from like an ox to a farm implement. That's easy to measure. It's a lot more difficult in the service sector. But Think of capital. The second one is labor investment or labor deepening. That's training. Right? That's higher skills. And then the third one, and I sometimes joke, this is the hardest to actually achieve, is management, right? So economists call this total factor productivity, which is kind of combining the two. If you can do those things, right? So you can invest in those things, that will boost productivity and productivity growth. And unfortunately, it's really frustrating to identify these types of expansions in real time, right? So in the 90s, again, I think it was Robert Gordon who said, you know, productivity is everywhere except the statistics, because in real time, the stats that we're looking at to measure productivity are not great, and they never really show what we're feeling, you know? So again, in the 90s, we all remember the productivity expansion. You know, we knew something was at work with the advent of the internet, but we couldn't really place our finger on it, but we knew it was boosting the stall speed of the economy. And the reason that's important, and this now relates to your question, I think, is, you know, to the previous question we were having about the argument over productivity and what it means for inflation. If you have a higher rate of productivity growth and you combine that with labor, you get what's called the potential growth rate of an economy, right? So the ways to boost potential growth is to have higher rates of productivity growth or higher rates of the kind of labor force engagement. And if you manage to boost potential growth, which I think is happening in the US right now, it means your economy is better able to withstand inflation shocks, right? So you have a higher stall speed of the economy. You're operating at a higher potential growth rate, and you're better able to take, you know, temporary shocks to the rate of inflation. So it's a win for central bankers as well, which is something, again, that Deputy Governor Carolyn Rogers discusses in her speech. Now, what does that mean for sort of where we are now, what stocks have done, and kind of the path of policy? It's always very difficult to know in the moment if we're actually experiencing a productivity expansion, but I think the evidence around the U.S. pulling away at this point is too significant to ignore, right? Again, like we mentioned, the U.S. economy is, you know, over 11 or almost 12% larger than it was at the start of 2019 in inflation-adjusted terms, right? Taking into account the huge rise in inflation. Other G7 economies, that number is like 0 or 2%, right? Much, much lower. So the evidence that the U.S. is pulling away is significant. You know, as a quick aside, Pierre, I was a couple of weeks ago, I was at a conference in Germany hosted by the German Central Bank, the Bundesbank, and the National Association for Business Economics, this association that I'm a part of. And, you know, it's all Chatham House rules and we can't really discuss it. But this idea of the U.S. pulling away was raised in a number of sessions. And someone joked, you know, the U.S. creates the IP that the world steals, right? I mean, you know, I definitely won't attribute that one to anyone, but, you know, I think it's really telling. And so the last point though is, what does this mean for rates, right? And neutral rates and R-star and monetary policy. And this is where things get a little bit murkier and maybe a little bit scarier, right? So, I mean, if we are in the midst of a productivity expansion and potential growth in the U.S. is higher than it's been for the last 20 years, and inflation is generally slowing, I mean, I know it's been stubborn recently, but if inflation is generally slowing, if GDP growth is printing, you know, in the high twos, low threes, if earnings are being revised higher, if the labor market is doing well, right? If every arrow is up, essentially,
right?
Someone actually raised the question: how do we know we're not at neutral now? again, that sort of stopped me in my tracks a little bit, right? Because just remember, the last, you know, not that long ago, probably right before we spoke, I mean, towards the end of last year, there were 6 cuts in the U.S. priced in for this year. Now, I think most of us can agree that that was a little bit overdone. But, you know, 3 or 4 was kind of the sane consensus.
Right.
And now we're flirting with none or maybe half or one, you know. And it's because I think we're slowly coming to this realization that, number one, the stall speed of the U.S. economy has increased. And if that's the case, it means the neutral rate of interest, so that interest rate at which supply and demand in the economy are balanced, is higher than it's been in the past.
It's not 2%. It's maybe 2.5 or 3.
It's maybe 3, or maybe it's 3.5. Maybe
3.5. Yeah. Still,
I mean, you know,
and that's why it's scary.
Exactly. This is why it's scary. I mean, I discussed this on a call this morning internally. Unfortunately. You know, so I don't know where neutral is. You know, the experts that you speak to and the folks that we see on BNN, they don't know.
Right.
And to be quite honest, neither does the Bank of Canada and neither does the Federal Reserve, right? So the central banks themselves don't actually know where neutral is. There's going to be a little bit of sort of fumbling around in the dark to find neutral, because I don't believe it's where we are now, right? Because there are very, very tentative early signs of some slowing. But you know, for the Federal Reserve, they have to balance a very rare productivity expansion. I mean, those happened, you know, 2 or 3 times in our lifetime. So you don't want to extinguish the fire by being excessively restrictive for too long. But you don't necessarily want that getting any bigger and rewinding all of the progress you've had on inflation. So it's a really, really difficult scenario, which is why they are now taking this data dependent approach, right? Which is now like the most popular word in central banks.
Amazing. Amazing, Ilan. That's a really interesting insight. So Ilan, I want to introduce the episode and then we'll continue. Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. Ilan Colette, Institutional Portfolio Manager in Fidelity's Global Asset Allocation Team, is here.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Ilan, I mean, we've already been chatting. It's really exciting to have you back at this moment, especially, but it's exciting to have you back all the same.
Thanks for coming here. Yeah, I always really enjoy these chats.
Yeah, and so I'm looking forward to catching up with you. So we've been talking, equity. As we're talking, equity volatility is quite low again. Here and there we've had some spurts, and maybe the VIX, as a measure of the volatility of the Standard & Poor's 500, might not be a full indicator. It's kind of an aggregate of all volatility. It might not speak to any specific volatility that's going on. But after a spurt, after we had that sort of blip in March, April, stocks have gone to new highs, and bonds, and I credit you with bringing it to my attention, at least, is rates volatility as measured by the MOVE index has remained consistently elevated, problematic even, right? I mean, are stocks, do you think stocks are more or less vulnerable here? And are bonds looking more attractive here or more volatile? And I know we're going to get into talking about some of the new additions that you've made to the global asset allocation mandate. And what's in store for what do you see in store now? Because I'm assuming that your view has changed somewhat since we spoke in the early part of the year. And with bonds skirting, 20-year lows, so much has changed, right? It's been kind of wonky.
No, it really has. I mean, it relates to the conversation we were having, earlier. I really think the question here is, are we in the midst of a productivity expansion and a potential growth rate expansion in the U.S.? You know, as we discussed, the U.S. has very clearly pulled away. And the way that we're positioning for that in our multi-asset class portfolios for Canadian investors is we're overweight. We're trying to lean into this, right? So we're overweight. Right. We're overweight U.S. equities specifically in our globally diversified multi-asset class portfolios. We're more cautious around Canada, which I'm sure we'll get to. But I mean, again, we are overweight U.S. equities because if we are in the midst of a productivity expansion, even a slight lean into that in cumulative space could have really important implications for end investors. You know, I think we may have talked about this last time, but
you're not investing. Obviously, you say you're overweight in U.S. equities, but that doesn't mean you're overwhelmingly in U.S. equities. It's a component of the portfolio.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. Right. So
it's not in a vacuum. I mean, it's not in isolation that you're in U.S.
Exactly
that you're overweight.
Right. I mean, yeah. So the way that the funds are structured is there's really two elements to success. The first is we assemble a great team of underlying managers, right? Many of whom listeners will be familiar with, the Mark Schmales, the Hugo Lavallees, right. The Dan DuPonts, the Andrew Marchese's, right? Really, really good underlying Will Danoff's, underlying great equity managers who have their own process and who are incentivized to beat their own benchmark. So that's the first step, right? Assemble a great team And as a quick aside, no managers are ever forced upon us, right? We pick the team. And then the second element is, you know, we lean in or out of asset classes, geographies, styles, or sectors based on what our research-based process is indicating we should do, right? So myself, David Tulp, David Wolf, we all come from a macro and research background. So that really underpins everything we do. And in October of last year, so this would have been before the last time we spoke, we really started to gain conviction in this view that the U.S. might be in the midst of a productivity expansion, right? And so the stall speed of the U.S. economy may be higher than what we've observed it to be for the last 20 or 25 years. And to be clear on this, we don't actually know, well, it's not really in the productivity stats yet. And honestly, we may not even know the source of it for some time, right? So some of this can feel a little hand-wavy because we don't know if it's investments in AI or if it's investments in clean technology, you know, or if it's industrial policy leading to a really huge increase in CapEx in the U.S., which I think has kind of gone unnoticed for the large part. And, right. and we don't know if it's, you know, sort of imploding the standard 9-to-5 so that we can be more efficient with our time, right? So that I don't have to go to Costco on the weekends anymore. And so, you know, we don't really know which ingredient it is or maybe it's a combination of those things. And we won't really know, but, you know, not to sound aloof, but I don't think I care, right? If it's leading to an increase in the stall speed of the U.S. economy, who cares where it's coming from if that's the result? And if that's the result, I mean, I'm being a little provocative here. If that's the result and the stall speed of the U.S. is higher, we want to be leaning into that theme. And that's right. That's a position that we initiated in October of last year. But again, we're always incremental. You know, we're always incremental. We're not swinging the funds around month to month. We're very research-based and incremental. And then, Pierre, to your question, I mean, you know, valuations are an important input and pillar into our investment process, right? Our pillars are macro, sentiment, valuation, and bottom-up analysis from the underlying PMs right. that we use. And so valuations and sentiment, I mean, again, I would say those are the reasons why that overweight to the U.S. is not twice as big as it is right now, right? Is we have to kind of be mindful of a little bit of exuberance right now around the names that have lifted those indices. But we don't want to ignore what could be a once in a three decade productivity expansion. Last time this happened was the 90s, right? So, and we remember what happened to US equities in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah. I mean, I'm asking you, maybe I'm asking you the wrong question, you know, because I mean, your process is comprehensive. It's not, you know, singularly trying to make calls on the U.S. equity market or the Canadian equity market or the bond market, foreign bonds, you know, domestic bonds. It's not about singularly making any call. It's actually about covering as many bases as you can for the sake of not necessarily knowing definitely not knowing what's coming in the future, but being prepared for it. I mean, that's the whole point of the global asset allocation strategy, is to position for all outcomes, ideally.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the way that we serve the advisors that use our funds and our end investors the best is, and I think the reason our managed solutions are 95% peers beaten over a 10-year horizon is because, so that predates me, right? Because of those two ingredients into the process, right? So the first part, again, you choose a great slate of managers who are, I mean, really, like each one of these managers has a return stream and a volatility expectation in an Excel spreadsheet. And so you don't want overlap, right? You want even diversification amongst managers, right? So that when you combine them, like combining managers means the ride for the end investor is smoother. And right. then the other right. way that we can, you know, the other way that we can kind of smooth out the ride for the end investor is lean in or out incrementally into these themes, which will all be research based, right? So, you know, and these are rigorous conversations, like the conversations that I'm having with my colleagues on the team, with our CIO, you know, like every day is report card day. So,
you know, these are, you're always being evaluated.
Exactly. So these are rigorous conversations, you know, stress testing the themes and the underlying conviction and the size of the position that we have in terms of the tactical overweight or underweight throughout the fund, that will reflect conviction, right? So, you know, we have a significant underweight to Canadian equities right now, a significant underweight to the Canadian dollar. Those are higher conviction views. You know, our emerging market overweight right now isn't huge, but it's a slight overweight, and that reflects the conviction we have there, right? And so not every single view we have is table pounding conviction, but we think right. about the views across a huge range of asset classes.
I can't help thinking, you know, when you know, talking to advisors and looking at model port, you know, this might not necessarily apply to advisors who use a lot of model portfolios in their practice, but for those who aren't, you know, advisors tend to add incremental, you know, slices of alternatives of diversified return streams to their portfolios. And, you know, things they like, things that are, you know, hopefully uncorrelated to their core, and not always, but they do. But I can't help thinking that because of the line item argument, that they're not necessarily doing, they might be doing too much in, you know, their home country bias slice. They might be doing too much in the U.S. equity slice, because that's what's hot, and that's what the client is harping about, or, you know, the client's neighbors harping to them about, you know, why aren't we, you know, more overweight there? Why don't we have and less, you know, and have underweight over here? So they're either doing too much of one thing and not enough of the others, and. You know, if they could achieve a balance without it having to be a quarterly, quarterly conversation with their clients about diversification, you know, it's a constant, it's an uphill battle for advisors, right? Is the arguing in favor of diversification is probably the one thing that's the most, you know, demanding of advisors, right? It's easy to throw in the towel sometimes and say, okay, this is what you want to do, this is what we'll do. But obviously that's not the advisor's job, and that's outside of their fiduciary responsibility as well, in terms of advising. Right. So
yeah, I don't mean to cut you off, Pierre, but I really am sympathetic to advisors and those really difficult conversations they have to have with their clients, where every client's neighbor has told them about, you know, the best stock they've ever owned.
Yeah.
And again, everyone kind of brags about the wins, but no one discusses, again, I was raised in Ottawa, so no one ever discusses holding Nortel till the end, you know?
God.
So yeah. Like the way I think about our portfolios, again, that I'm also personally invested in, is they're really elegant solutions to really complex problems, right? And so,
right.
You know, you want to be diversified across managers of different styles and geographies, check. You want to be diversified across asset classes, check. You want, you know, you don't want your grandfather's 60-40. You need a 60-40 that has tactical flexibility as well to use, I don't know, the full breadth of Fidelity research to lean in or out of asset classes. And then the other thing is, the last two things are, one, you want the flexibility you want those portfolios, like the ones that we manage, to be kind of living and breathing, meaning there's continuous research underpinning those portfolios, not just in terms of assessing risk and return, but also in terms of assessing, are there new asset classes that could potentially improve the risk-adjusted return experience for the end investor that we have access to that we want to add? And then the last part is, you know, very, very strict and stringent peer evaluation. Right. So this is that's one part that to me in this job.
That's a great segue to talking about your latest white paper.
Yep.
On how you're changing your asset allocation and what you're adding to it. Right. I mean, you've decided in your strategy that, I mean, you discuss adding three alternative sleeves to the global asset allocation strategy. So why don't we talk about that and talk about why you're building in these alternative investments into the portfolio?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is really exciting. This is something that we describe in a lot of detail in our Q2 thought leadership paper called "Towards the Balanced Fund of the Future." That I would welcome everyone to read. I think it's three pages. It's investor friendly. It should be jargon free, and I'm sure we can share it. But
we'll include it with the in the show notes.
Oh, super! That's great. Yeah. I think there are two questions. Like, what are we doing? Or maybe a few questions. What did we do? Why did we do it? And also, why now?
Right.
So, what did we do after close to around a year of research? We decided to add small slivers to three Fidelity Canada liquid alternative strategies that now have a 3-year track record of performance. These strategies, which we describe in the paper, are run by managers that we know and we're quite familiar with, right? Global Value Long Short, run by Dan DuPont, and then two other strategies run by David Way and Brett DeLay. That are slightly different in flavor and I would say, are sourced from different areas of the portfolio, whether it be a cash substitute or an equity substitute. But the most important thing here is what we did is we added a small slice of each one of these to the managed portfolio suite.
Right.
And in doing that, I mean, the backcast or the statistical analysis that we performed suggested to us that adding these, again, this is all backcast, right? So adding these improved the risk-adjusted return of those managed portfolios very slightly. And so there's a couple of nuances there. The first is, I mean, in the paper, we have this nice risk and return scatter plot. I mean, who doesn't love a good scatter plot?
And absolutely.
And the where risk is here and return is here. And
right.
You know, the inclusion of a total allocation of 5% to these three portfolios, which is just an example, shifts the risk and return dots very slightly up and to the left, meaning slightly less risk and slightly more return. Now, you'll notice I use the word slightly like six times in the last few sentences. And that's because the inclusion of these liquid alternatives does not and should not change the broad contours of these portfolios that investors have come to expect, right? So Pierre, you know, I used to joke that when I was on the road, I did 60 flights last year. And when I was on the road, last year I got two questions continually. So 2022 was the year in which I got, the only question I got was about GICs. 2023 was the year in which the questions were, when are you going to add liquid alternatives to the portfolio? And then the second question was, what are liquid alternatives? Right. And
that's funny.
You know, what we tried to do in the paper, again, is just explain in plain English what these are and what they are not, and the reason for including them. But again, that slight change to the risk and return trade-off, it's intentionally slight, right? And it's intentionally slight because we don't want to change the underlying return and risk sort of parameters or expectations that advisors and investors have come to know in our portfolios.
Right.
But these are managers that we are very familiar with. They have an excellent track record over the past 3 years. And, you know, the backcast shows that they can improve the kind of diversification qualities of our funds. And so we want to take advantage of these capabilities, these in-house capabilities, when they become available. You know, the last thing to mention here, and then I'll come up for a bit of water, is sort of why now? And I think this is a really interesting one, and it speaks a lot, I think, to the Fidelity DNA. You know, forever, alternative investments were only on the menu for institutional investors, sovereign right. wealth funds, pension plans, large family offices, right? So it was just an asset class that wasn't really available to a retail investor. And one of the things that we're trying to do with the inclusion of these liquid alternatives is a bit of a sort of democratization of access to these coveted asset classes that that really haven't been available to retail investors or advisors really ever.
Right.
And so that's, again, I think that's something that's a unique thing that we're bringing in, packaged already into the managed solution that many folks who are listening right now either already own or will own soon.
I have to say, like, I love that because, you know, we've spent the last 2 or 3 years now in many, many conversations like this one, talking about alternatives, diversification, portfolio construction, risk management, you know, uncorrelated streams of return, adding them, you know, to your core and, you know, your core portfolios in order to provide, you know, that offset, that ballast when you need it. When bonds, like in 2022, couldn't do it.
Exactly.
And so, you know, it's like, by doing that, you're also giving the liquid alternative category an endorsement.
Yeah,
by integrating it in you know, it would almost be weird if you didn't do it. Just like you said, you know, the question you were getting,
yeah,
and not necessarily in that order,
yeah,
is when are you going to add liquid alternatives to your portfolios?
Right.
And secondly, what is a liquid alternative?
Right.
And
exactly, right? Yeah, and you know, so you're right. I mean, what I would say, Pierre, there is, it was really,
it's like you're eating your own cooking, really. I mean,
that's exactly it. That's exactly,
right.
I mean, that's the
perfect, you're saying, you know, we're all out there talking, pounding the pavement, talking to everybody about, you know, you should add some liquid alternatives. You should add some of these uncorrelated return, you know, investments to your portfolio, things that aren't stocks and things that aren't bonds. Yeah. Things that behave differently so that when, you know, when something goes wrong, you've got other assets that are holding up the, you know, holding up the table. And
right. And you know, the nice thing with Fidelity and the team that we're on, right? So we report in, as we've discussed in the past, we report into the broader global asset allocation organization headquartered in Boston.
Right. Right?
They're managing, I don't know, $900 billion of assets. We're also plugged in, very plugged into Fidelity Canada, right? And so the bench, so the roster of players that we can choose from in terms of managers and in terms of asset classes is amazing, right? So, you know, oftentimes this comes up as, you know, oh, you don't have access. So for example, we launched a fund in September of 21, the inflation focused fund. I think it was the best timed fund launch in Fidelity's history. But so we launched this fund in September of 21 that had global inflation linked bond mandate, right? Again, not a mandate that a regular investor would have access to, but because of our scale and scope and the breadth, you know, we have access to those types of things. And so, Pierre, I think like eating your own cooking is exactly the right way to phrase it. We really know, I mean, David Way, Brett DeLay, Dan DuPont, these are folks that we are talking to very, very regularly. We're there's a continuous conversation with them in terms of their views and their process. We know them, we're comfortable with them. And most importantly, we have a 3-year track record with their liquid alternatives that showed statistically exactly what it could potentially do in our funds. You know, the one thing I'd mention there is there will be other, in fact, there's one that already exists, run by Ritu Kumra, an alternative strategy that examines the ratings that Fidelity Canada analysts have on stocks and tries to lever that. Again, a really unique strategy. It's not included right now, but you could imagine, you know, again, that's a manager that we're very familiar with and researchers that we're familiar with. If and when we want to add a capability, whether it be an asset class or a manager, we'll always do the same thing. We'll do the due diligence. We'll work with our researchers. We'll make sure that it's that we can expect it to be a diversifier. And then we'll add it in a small slice. You know, there's a very, very set process for doing this. So we're not just, you know, things aren't just getting thrown in and out. You know, it's a very, very slow and methodical process, but again, that's also some of that, Fidelity DNA.
Yeah. I mean, I can't see it happening quickly, you know, because, you know, Fidelity has a reputation for being very thoughtful and measured and, you know, I can't see you as an organization making any bold or rash moves without heavily considering it first. So
no, and as you mentioned, you know,
like, I love the time. I love the timing of you doing this, you adding the alternatives to the global asset allocation strategy, because, as I said, it's a you know, you're giving credence to all the arguments that are being made, arguments that are being made for doing that, for everyone to start considering adding. Like, we're entering this period now, which has so much uncertainty attached with it. And, you know, someone else was telling me that most of the people that are in the business today, even the ones who have been in the business since 19, you know, it doesn't go beyond 1980.
Right.
Yeah. In terms of having a personal experiential perspective to bring to investing money. And, you know, we all know 1981 is when interest rates peaked, and then we had a 40-year cycle of interest rates coming down for 40 years. But now we're at this period where, you know, rates are higher. They've gone higher. They might stay higher. They may possibly go higher. There's a small possibility that, at least it seems, there's a small possibility that isn't off the table. But we're in this period where, at the very least, we're in a period of higher for longer, and that's going to make the assets we've been, you know, we've known and loved, behave very differently than the ones we know and love.
I think this is it. Like, so.
Yeah. So you have to have these other,
You really do. I mean, I think this question has various, that same question has a different form almost in every year, right? So in 2022, 23, it was like, is 60/40 dead, right? And one way to sort of mold the is 60/40 dead is with our entire discussion that we just had around liquid alternatives, right? That I could have provided that same answer with is 60/40 dead.
Right.
You know, and again, I our industry loves playbooks, right? So we just love playbooks, but I don't think there are some elements of what we do where the playbook just doesn't work, right? Because the investable universe doesn't look anything like it did 50 years ago. You know, whether it be the rate environment or even the asset classes that are available, right? And so the reception to our inclusion of alternatives and, you know, our partnership with Brookfield in our private investment pools with physical real estate, again, so liquid alternatives in the managed portfolios and private real estate managed by Brookfield in the private investment pools, the reception to both of those developments has been overwhelmingly positive. And again, it's a very, very small slice, but you know, keeping the stocks and the bonds as the core allocations in the portfolios. But I think 2022 was the year in which we all learned many, many lessons, right? Where playbooks were ripped up and, you know, correlations inverted. And really, anyone who works in the multi-asset class space, you know, at best you preserved basis points, right? I mean, unless you went into CAT, USD and gold, I mean, it was pretty hard to eke out a positive absolute return. And so what we did in that period is we used, you know, we used the underweight of the Canadian dollar and commodities as important diversifiers to preserve basis points.
Right.
But I do think that was the year in which the wheels started to turn around. Are there asset classes that are now being run in-house that we think can improve, you know, some of the diversification qualities of the funds that we manage? So that was sort of where it all started. And what we ended up with was that paper that we'll reference actually was published the day that the allocations were funded. So it was, you know, we were landing many fighter jets on the aircraft carrier yeah. at once.
Right.
Which is might be a bit too exciting of a metaphor, but yeah, so far the reception has been, you know, kind of overwhelmingly positive, I would say.
Yeah, and I mean it might be important to mention or to consider the idea, like for those listening, that this was the culmination of how many what period of time was this being considered for?
Well, so the liquid alternatives have just over a 3-year track record now. We have much longer experience with the underlying managers in some of their different strategies. But in terms of the research that went in to the inclusion, I mean, it's at least a year in the making, right? So it started over a year ago because at first, you know, we're working with researchers with a clean whiteboard, a clean piece of paper. And then we slowly iterate in terms of, you know, the properties, where these alts should be funded from, what's the right allocation, you know, what's the max sort of drawdown that we can expect or upside capture. And then even once all of that is done, there are discussions, you know, iterative discussions with our CIO, with folks on the product side, right? So there are many, many hoops. And there were many, many people involved, you know, that I'll thank one day in an acceptance speech. But you know, there's an entire team of unsung heroes yep. on the research side who help us come to the right allocation and the right decision in terms of the inclusion. So it's a very, very slow process. But again, that's that Fidelity DNA, right? So that's going to be the case.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've answered, I mean, you've talked about the position sizing, but, you know, that in itself is one of the most difficult things to come to a conclusion on is, you know, okay, we want to add these new vehicles, these new instruments to the, you know, these new investments to the strategy. Now, okay, what size do we do that in? Like, how do we do that? And what's the optimal amount and what's the outcome, you know? And that's this whole year you've spent, you know, figuring that out. And it wasn't a decision that came about for any other reason, except that it was something that you could consider doing for a very long time.
Well, exactly. Right.
And a sustainable decision. I mean, not something that was a reaction to what's happening in the market, but rather, you know, what's to come.
No, absolutely. I mean, we never, ever want to be reactionary. Well, we don't want to be reactionary, whether it's a tactical asset allocation decision. And we certainly don't want to be reactionary in terms of kind of the strategic construction of the asset mix at the fund level, right? We always want to be really thoughtful, really incremental. And again, I mean, this is what I think advisors and investors have come to expect from the Fidelity Managed Solutions is that, you know, sort of slow and steady pathway to 95% peers beaten over a 10-year horizon, right? I mean, that's kind of the proof statement is that that slow and methodical approach is the one we're always going to take, whether it's me talking to you or, you know,
right.
or my colleagues, that's always going to be the case. But at the same time, we don't want to ignore innovative capabilities that are developed in-house with fantastic managers, right? We don't want to have the blinders on. We don't want this to be our grandfather's or father's 60-40. We have to continually innovate, but in a really deliberate manner.
Fantastic. Ilan, always great to catch up with you. Sure. I was really looking forward to this conversation, and now I know why.
I really do enjoy these conversations.
Yeah.
Here. Like, it's a, honestly, I mean, you should be hosting some of our conversations here at Fidelity. Like, it's a very easy conversation. So
thank you.
You know, I appreciate it. And yeah, happy in September if you want to do a kind of a back to school chat and see where we're at kind of at that point in the year and what's left for the remainder of the year. That'd be great.
Absolutely. I'd love to do that.
Super.